was thinking about some of the connections that our church has with yours. Of course, Pastor Curry was on staff at our church for years. I think, was it right before you came up here? Yeah, so Pastor Curry, obviously. And then Rachel Ginsky, who's here at your church now, was a member at our church for a long time and graduated from our high school. And her parents are members at our church, as well as her sister and brother-in-law and her two nieces as well. And then Hannah Solsted is a member of our church. Is it Hannah Perrone? Used to be, yeah. So might have known her, but we're thankful to have her at our church as well. And so there might be some other connections. Those are the ones that come to mind right away. So again, we're thankful for you all, and we're excited to be back here tonight, looking at a little bit more critical look at something that you might be familiar with. And so in order to think about this topic of love, let me just begin by asking a few questions. Don't you hate it when people don't return love to you? You know what I'm talking about? You go the extra mile, you show an act of kindness, you state a clear word of encouragement, and the person responds with criticism or coldness or unconcern. Maybe the place that this is most often seen is in the home. You know, the parent to the ungrateful teenager. I do and do and do and do for you, and this is the thanks I get, right? I mean, you don't do anything in return for me, sometimes is our thought. Or maybe a wife standing at a stove after working for hours to prepare a meal. I cooked this nice dinner for you, and all you have to say is the chicken is a little tough. I mean, I was expecting more than that after all the work that I put in. Can a parent or a wife in those situations show love even if there is no corresponding response in return? Or does love have to be returned? Does it have to go both ways? Is it a transaction where I give something to you, then you give it back? That seems more loving. We get frustrated when people don't acknowledge the love that we express to them. We don't like it when people don't recognize the gifts that we have and the gifts that we give. And so what is it in our hearts that are causing us to get so frustrated often at the people that are closest to us? What I mean by that is that our culture teaches us that the people who love us most are the people who are most affirming to us. And so our culture says, listen to those people. Put around you people who will affirm you, will like you for who you are, who won't tell you otherwise. And the God that our culture seeks after is a God who will accept us as we are and will never push us to change. And so we look at how people respond when they respond with criticism. We say, we can't accept that. You must not love me. That's the kind of friends that our culture craves, people who never say a cross word or question any of our actions or motives. We want to live in a judgment-free zone where when we do something, it's acknowledged and returned, and where no one says anything cross against us, even if it's truth. We might especially feel unloved when we compare ourselves to others on social media, and so we think the answer is, well, maybe I'm doing this thing the wrong way. Maybe I need to figure out how to be better at social media. So if I'm going to receive more affection, then maybe I need to give some out. And so we go around. In fact, this is the experts say. If you want more likes on Facebook, then you need to comment on other people's posts. Like their pages and their posts and engage with people who follow you. And then when you say something, when you make a statement, they're going to like that. And it'll explode with all these likes and loves and whatever, laughs or whatever you're looking for. They say, if you do this, then you raise the chances of getting likes. It's important to add to the conversation of other influencers' pages. It will get their attention and the attention of followers, which is a good thing for you. So, if we want something, we need to give something. That's kind of the idea of our culture's idea of love. And at the heart of it is this apparent need to feel loved. That is, that that somehow we can't reach our highest potential if we're not loved like we want to be loved. And so the question that we have to consider is this a real need or a perceived need? And where do we go for the answers? Where do we go for the answers? And so the first place we turn is we go to the Bible. And the challenge in going to the Bible and trying to understand what love is that the word love, and it, in its many forms, is used 750 times, more than 750 times. In the Old Testament, we have the idea of God's loving kindness for His people, His special love for Israel. Then we go to the New Testament, and we see that Jesus summarizes all the Old Testament laws into two, love God and love your neighbor. And so we understand that love is more than an action, because we're commanded to love with all of our heart and soul and mind and strength, with all of who we are. So we have a general idea, but how do we simplify or clarify something that's extremely complex, lots of different things, and I'll show you what that looks like. Turn over to Ephesians chapter 5. Ephesians chapter 5. Here's this command for us to love. We're going to turn to a number of passages tonight. Ephesians chapter 5, verse 1, Paul tells us to walk in love. Therefore, be imitators of God as beloved children. And then verse 2 reads, walk in love, just as Christ also loved you and gave himself up for us as an offering and a sacrifice to God as a fragrant aroma. So we're commanded to walk in love. So the first part of Ephesians tells us who we are, chapters 1 through 3, and then chapter 4 says, walk worthy of your calling. And here's what walking worthy of your calling is. And one of those things is, in chapter 5, verses 1 and 2, it means to walk in love. You need to live a life that expresses itself in love. Turn over to 1 Timothy chapter 6. Paul again says we need to be engaged in this choice to love. Of course, we're commanded in many other places to do this, but chapter 6, 1 Timothy chapter 6, verse 11 says, flee from these things, and these things are referring to the proud obsessions that he's just been talking about, godliness without contentment, and the love of money. So instead of going after those things, ungodliness and this love of money and this proud obsessions, then you need to pursue love. He says, you man of God, pursue righteousness, godliness, faith, love, perseverance, and gentleness. He goes on, fight the good fight of faith. Take hold of the eternal life to which you were called, and you made the confession in the presence of many witnesses. So here's another command that we have, that we must be engaged in love. Of course, you know, husbands, that you are commanded to love your wives in Ephesians chapter 5. Older women are to teach younger women how to love their husbands. But this goes beyond just our own home, doesn't it? It goes beyond the people in our church. We're actually to love our neighbors. And Jesus, remember when he was asked, who is my neighbor? Basically said, anybody within your circle of influence. When you walk past somebody on the road, you need to love that person. And so this complexity increases of what this love looks like. What it's supposed to be when we put something like loving our spouse alongside of one of these other kinds of loves that we're called to do, which is in Matthew 5:44, to love your enemies. Well, I love my spouse in one way, but how do I love my enemy like I love my spouse? There's some nuance to it, isn't there? And so we want answers from the Bible, and that's good that we go there as the very first place to find those answers. But someone needs to explain it to us. We feel like the Ethiopian eunuch, right? Like, I know there's stuff in there about love, but can someone just explain this to me in a way that simplifies things? And so one of the places we might go is to a Christian bookstore. And we find a book like this, Five Love Languages by Gary Chapman. Gary Chapman is a man who graduated from Moody Bible Institute. Hey, that sounds like a good place to go. Wheaton College, and then got his PhD from Southwestern Baptist Theological Seminary. Now I'm getting my degree here from Southern Baptist Theological Seminary. It's one of the six Southern Baptist seminaries in the country, and Southwestern's a good one. They've had some trouble recently, but they're Orthodox. And so here you have a guy with a degree from a good seminary. And right now he's in our stripe. He's a Baptist. He's a pastor at the senior associate pastor of Calvary Baptist Church in Winston-Salem, North Carolina, and has been on staff there for some 39 years. He spends a lot of time counseling couples, so surely, if anyone is going to tell us what love looks like, and specifically, he's focusing on what it looks like in the home, then it's someone like this, who has a good pedigree, who has gone to a good seminary, who is pastoring churches and is actually being practical with people, who is concerned about the scriptures and explaining it well, and he's doing it to a popular, to a large audience. His book has sold over 11 million copies in English. So somehow he's struck a chord among people who are trying to figure out what love is. The first edition was written back in 1992. And he focuses on the idea of love languages. As far as I can tell, the idea of love languages is original to Chapman. But it seems like he draws it from another book that focuses on the love tank. Perhaps you've heard of that idea. You know, whether your love tank is full. So you got to try to work to get the other person's love tank full so that they'll fill your love tank up. That's from a Christian psychology book called Love is a Choice. And so it seems like Chapman's just taking that kind of idea and repackaging it in a way that's understandable and simple. And the point of Chapman's book is to persuade the reader that people speak different love languages. He argues that there are five love languages that we all speak to some degree, and that the key to a happy and healthy relationship, primarily focused on marriage, is to be able to speak the love language that your spouse speaks, or your child speaks, or whomever you're interacting with. So the first love language is called words of affirmation, so speaking kind words. Second is quality time. Third is receiving gifts. Fourth is acts of service. And the fifth is physical touch. There's no pizza or ice cream in there for the love. Those tend to be my love languages, but Chapman makes some helpful observations that I think we would find as we read through this book. We'd be like, yeah, this makes sense. This fits with what Scripture says. And one of the things that I would commend him the most about is that you are seeking out what your spouse desires. That's a good thing. You ought to know what pleases your spouse. You ought to desire to please him or her in the way that he or she wants to be pleased. That makes sense. We don't just say, hey, this is what I want to give you, even though you want to receive something else. So I think we can commend that. Here's another thing that came up. I think I have a quotation here. Not quite. So I'll just read this for you. He says, forgiveness is the way of love. I'm amazed by how many individuals mess up every new day with yesterday. This is bitterness and resentment and revenge. And his point is, you need to forgive. One of the keys to a good, healthy Christian relationship is forgiveness. Wouldn't we all agree with that? Absolutely. And then he says later on, what we do for each other before marriage is no indication of what we will do after marriage. After marriage, we tend to revert to being the people we were before we fell in love. And so what he's saying is, if you want to start changing, change now. Don't wait till you get married. Marriage doesn't generally change you. It generally reveals who you are. We'll talk about that a little bit more later. So here we have a resource about love from a biblical perspective. But the question is he right? Is Chapman's teaching about love consistent with the Bible? And I've already suggested there are some things in there that are helpful. And while the book can be helpful, I think there are two fundamental flaws that should make us cautious about how we use this book and how we use this method in our own relationships as a means to relational strength. So the first main flaw with the book, number one, is that He teaches that love is a psychological need. That love is a psychological need. And as I'm looking at that, I can see it's very small, so I'm assuming it's small for you as well. So I'll read these for you. Or I could just hold this up like this. You guys can follow along. Maybe not. So here's some examples of where he's, like, why I say that. I'm not just trying to be rude or something. I'm trying to represent him well, or at least fairly. How about that? When your spouse's emotional love tank is full and he feels secure in your love, the whole world looks bright and your spouse will move out to reach his highest potential in life. So fill up your spouse's love tank. That will make them feel secure. That will allow them to reach their highest potential. Earlier in the book, he says, psychologists have concluded that the need to feel loved is a primary human and emotional need. And when he states that, he's agreeing with that, because later on he says, child psychologists affirmed that the basic emotional needs for every child is love. And then the emotional need for love is a fundamental to our nature. At the heart of humankind's existence is the desire to be intimate and to be loved by one another. She's saying at the very core of who we are as humans is a need to feel loved. Our most basic emotional need, he goes on to say, is not to fall in love, but to be genuinely loved by another. He affirms what psychologist William James said, that possibly the deepest human need is the need to feel appreciated. And then towards the end of the book, he says, my sense of self-worth is fed by the fact that my spouse loves me. My self-esteem kind of grows when my spouse loves me. After all, if she loves me, I must be worth loving. Her love builds my self-esteem. So this is not just a one-time statement or just, you know, kind of a throw-off statement that he has in the book, and I'm just kind of harping on one small statement. This is pervasive throughout his writing. That we have a need, he says, to feel loved. And this idea of feeling loved as a psychological necessity is not original to Chapman, nor does he claim that it is. He often cites psychologists, as I've just cited on his behalf, and their studies. It seems to me that this idea of psychological need is derived from somebody you probably heard about in your Psych 101 class when you were going through college, Abraham Maslow. Abraham Maslow developed this hierarchy of needs. He was a psychology professor who developed this, by the way, a pagan psychology professor, who developed this hierarchy of needs in the mid-20th century. And he taught that a person's ultimate end in this life was to reach a place of self-actualization. This is the place where you can reach the highest potential that you possibly can be. You know, if you listen to some of these running apps when you're out there for a run, they say, be the best you that you can be. This is part of that, reaching your highest potential. You want to be the best you that you can possibly be. And what Maslow said is, if you want to be the best you, there has to be these foundational things that are covered first. And so the first one is physiological needs have to be met. So things like food and water. And then safety. You have to be safe before you can reach your highest potential. And then psychological needs. And inside that psychological need is this idea from which Chapman gets the foundation of his book, I would suggest. And that is that we must feel loved. We can't get to the highest potential in our lives unless we're loved. Now, I'm not sure that Chapman would fully embrace Maslow's model, but in his book, he certainly sounds like he embraces the need for love part, that middle section. And the problem with this kind of thinking for us as Christians is that the Bible never talks about us being unable to reach our fullest potential apart from human love. Turn over to Philippians chapter 4. Philippians chapter 4. Notice what Paul says about really accomplishing great things and being content, being at a place where he's reached what God has wanted him to be. He says in verse 11, not that I speak from want, for I have learned to be content in whatever circumstances I am. I know how to get along with humble means, and I also know how to live in prosperity. In any and every circumstance, I have learned the secret of being filled and going hungry, both of having abundance and suffering need. Now, that doesn't fit with Maslow's hierarchy of needs at all. As Paul says, I know how to be content. I know how to accomplish what God has called me to do without having that base level, that first one, that orange one there, that physiological needs met. I don't even have my food. Sometimes I go hungry. Sometimes I suffer need. And I've learned how to be content despite that. Consider the example of Jesus. Was there ever a time in Jesus' life when he was without the love of his people? Was there ever a time in Jesus' life when he hadn't reached his full potential? When he hadn't reached this place of what God had called him to do? Think about when he was in the wilderness. There's no human out there loving on him. He was alone. And then Zechariah said in prophecy of what would happen, he said, when the shepherd is struck, the sheep will be scattered. Talking about the time when he would go to the cross and the disciples would all disperse, while Jesus is all alone, largely during his trial and his crucifixion. And so I'll suggest that's the first problem, but I think there's a bigger problem with this book. The second fundamental flaw with this book, The Five Love Languages, is that Chapman teaches that love should expect a payback. This expectation of a payback. So let me just show you this from the book. For a particularly hard marriage case, Chapman counseled the wife using Jesus' word in Matthew 5:44, love your enemies. So the question that he had in mind, he said, was, could she do it? Could she love her enemy? And she's talking about it, her husband. Is it possible to love one who has cursed you, mistreated you, expressed feelings of contempt and hate for you? And if she could, would there be any payback? See what he's looking for her? He's saying, listen, what if you did this for a certain time? You started pouring out love for him. And then at some point, he turned it back on you. Wouldn't that be great? He goes on to ask, could that principle of loving an unlovely person possibly work in a marriage as far gone as Anne's? I decided to do an experiment. I would take as my hypothesis that if Anne could learn her husband's primary love language and speak it for a period of time, so that his emotional need for love was met, eventually he would reciprocate and begin to express love to her. I wondered, would it work? So again, his first question is, would there be any payback? And then the second question is, would it work? You might be thinking, well, isn't that what counselors are supposed to do? Aren't they supposed to help marriages? I mean, if we're giving counsel that does not work, then what's the point? I would suggest to you that the question should not be, will it work or does it work? The question should be, is it right? Is it right? What if it doesn't work? What if he doesn't reciprocate? What if he doesn't return the kind of love that she was expressing to him? Could she still be faithful to God without that? I mean, think about it, just to illustrate this point. What if a mother from the community here didn't want to follow through on a pregnancy, and she figured out that there is a workable way to get rid of this baby? And she asks the question, would it work? And from one sense, from legally, would it work? Well, yeah. You could get rid of the baby. But that's the wrong question, do you see? The right question is it right for you to get rid of this baby? And the same thing is true in marriage. It's not about what works, ultimately. That's a good question to ask. Will it work? But the main question that we should be asking is it right? Does what I'm doing match what God has called me to do in the Scriptures? A few more examples of Chapman's expected payback, this reciprocation idea. He says, make your spouse know your primary love language by constantly asking for the thing that you want most. So you know how to kind of subtly give your spouse the hint of what you want? Keep asking her what she wants. In the frequently asked questions sections, he says, what do you do if your wife knows your love language but fails to speak it? My suggestion is that you initiate the love tank game. On a scale of 0 to 10, how full is your love tank? If she answers anything less than 10, then you ask, what could I do to help fill it? Whatever she says, do it to the best of your ability. If you do this once a week for a month, chances are she will start asking you how full your love tank is. And you can begin making requests of her. This is a fun way of teaching her how to speak your love language. So you keep going after it, and eventually she'll figure it out and return in kind. I would say instead of this is a fun way of teaching her how to speak your love language, it's a fun way of getting what you ultimately want. It's a fun way of manipulating her. He says, you may also want to try giving indirect words of affirmation. That's saying positive things about yourself when he or she is not present. Eventually, someone will tell your spouse, and you'll get full credit for the love. So tell your wife's mother how great your wife is, he says. When her mother tells her what you said, it will be amplified, and you'll get even more credit. So talk well about your spouse around your in-laws. He goes on in not the scriptures. Page 52, compliment your spouse in the presence of his parents or friends. You'll get double credit. Your spouse will feel loved, and the parents will feel lucky to have such a great son-in-law. So, I'm guessing some of these were on here, but you couldn't read them anyway, so let's keep going. Before we get there, though, one more from him. He says, fill up your spouse's love tank. In so doing, his emotional tank is filled, and chances are he will reciprocate and speak your language. So again, it's always with this desire that if I can get what I want if I just pour myself into that other person. And this is part of the epidemic in our culture, isn't it? And in our Christian subculture. We've determined that we know what we need in order to be happy. And so we're willing to work at it for a while. You know what the implication that Chapman doesn't talk about is? What happens when it doesn't get reciprocated? Do you kind of give up? Or do you have to do it longer? What happens? I mean, are we willing to put ourselves out for someone else in a relationship? Or are we willing to put ourselves out for someone else in a relationship only as long as they give me something in return? And so what we've done is we've kind of come up with a point system in our relationships. So it's getting really quiet in here, which means this kind of topic is getting a little heavy. So I need to lighten it up a little bit. So bear with me as I just try to lighten things up here before we get into the text. In our world, love is often viewed as a point system. If you do this, I'll return the favor. Here's one man's point system that he developed in his marriage. So, you make the bed, plus one. You make the bed, but forget the decorative pillow, zero. You throw the bedspread over crumpled sheets, negative one. Here's a point system for her birthday. You forget her birthday, negative 50,000. You take her out for dinner, zero. You're supposed to do that. That's the base, guys. Take her out for dinner. You take her out to dinner, and it's not Buffalo Wild Wings, plus one. See, you're learning. Okay, it is Buffalo Wild Wings, negative two. It's Buffalo Wild Wings, and it's all you can eat night, negative three. It's Buffalo Wild Wings, it's all you can eat night, Michigan basketball is playing, and your face is painted maize and blue, negative 10. Here's another point system that he came up with regard to body shape, we could say. You develop a noticeable pot belly, negative 15. She didn't marry that, right? You develop a noticeable pot belly and exercise to get rid of it. Plus 10. Well done. You develop a noticeable pot belly and resort to baggy jeans and a Hawaiian shirt that are two sizes too big. Negative 30. You develop a noticeable pot belly and say to her, it doesn't matter, you have one too. Negative 8,000. It's kind of a silly example, but isn't this how we sometimes treat our marriages? Not to that kind of detail, but we tend to do things, keep points for what we've done, and then we keep points or negative points for what our spouse has done or has not done, and then we compare. And the expectation is that somehow, if I'm ahead, then my spouse needs to get where I'm at. And I think this is what Chapman wants us to believe, even if unintentionally. If we love in the way that he prescribes, that our spouse, our sibling, our parent will be compelled to reciprocate. But what if he or she doesn't pay us back? What if there's a lopsided relationship? Have you been there? Have you been the one whose love for someone else was so much higher than the other person's? Can I suggest to you that biblical love is not about how much I compel someone to do something for me? In fact, that's the opposite of love. Biblical love is measured by how much I'm willing to give of myself for others, listen to this, even if the other person doesn't return in kind. That's the kind of love that Jesus demands us to give. It's for the good of the other, no matter how they treat me or respond. So if we're going to understand what God says about love and use the kind of teaching that God gives us as a grid by which we understand what everyone else says about love, then we need to see what love is in this quest for genuine love. And so we're going to see what love is not, what love is, come up with a definition, and then some application, and we'll be done. All right. So first, genuine love does not keep score. Genuine love does not keep score. You might think, well, I never keep score in my relationships. I don't do what that guy was doing. But let me ask you a question. Have you ever had the thought, I am the one who forgives more than my spouse? Or I do more work around the house than my spouse does? 1 Corinthians 13:5 says, love does not keep a record of wrongs suffered. It doesn't keep a record. There's no tally sheet. Says, hey, remember what I did back there? We need to keep this up in the forefront of your mind so that you can reciprocate in some way. Love doesn't keep score. Secondly, genuine love... Oops. I guess we're still on this slide for a while. So, genuine love does not demand reciprocation. I would suggest if you are loving someone in order to get something back, then that is a form of manipulation. I will do this for you, but only because I expect that you will return the favor at some point. And in a way that I want to have it returned. Turn over to Luke 6, and we'll see this point. Luke 6. In verse 31, Jesus gives the principle of the golden rule that how you... would like to be treated. That's how you ought to treat other people. He says in verses 31 to 35 that love does not seek reciprocation. He says in verse 31, treat others the same way you want them to treat you. If you love those who love you, what credit is that to you? Even sinners love those who love them. If you do good to those who do good to you, what credit is that to you? Do you hear that kind of reciprocation idea? If you do something as an expression of love to someone who already loves you in return, who cares? Everybody does that. That's what the world does. Anybody can do that. Verse 33, if you do good to those who do good to you, what credit is that to you? For even sinners, unbelievers, do the same. Verse 34, if you lend to those from whom you expect to receive, what credit is that to you? Even sinners lend to sinners in order to receive back the same amount. Again, reciprocation. Expected reciprocation, but verse 35, but love your enemies, do good, lend, expecting nothing in return. That's a good way to describe love. right there. Doing something for the good of someone else without expecting return. And your reward will be great. You'll be sons of the Most High, for He Himself is kind to ungrateful and evil men. So he points us back to the ultimate example of God Himself. The pagans are quick to operate using a point system. And what do they do when people stop returning the love that they are showing? Dismiss. You're no longer part of my life. I'm just going to bring around people who are affirming of me. Remember? That's what we talked about at the beginning. That's what the pagans do. Jesus is calling for something greater than that. He says, how about giving without the thought of return? And that makes sense if we consider the principle of verse 31. We give like we want to have others give to us. In other words, we don't like it when people give us things with strings attached, do we? Do you know the kind of people that use you for just for you, and then they're quick to dismiss you after they're done using you? We don't like being like that. Jesus is saying, then you don't be like that. He's not saying in order to get something back from them. He's just saying, when you express love, make sure you're doing it in a one-sided kind of way, not expecting reciprocation. And if you do, you'll have great reward, verse 35. And you'll also demonstrate that you're a child of God, because this is how God loves. God doesn't make bargains with sinners, does He? If you do good works, I'll save you. God simply condescends to them and shows mercy. So if we're going to be a child of our Father, then we share His characteristics. We're merciful like He is. Merciful, undeserved. We don't give them what their sins deserve in grace. Gracious in that we give them what they don't deserve. Love does not keep a record of wrong, and it 1 Corinthians 13:5 says, love does not seek its own. This is the heart of Christian love, that our love is not self-seeking. It works for the glory of God and the good of the individual. It edifies. Thirdly, genuine love does not concern itself with personal cost. It does not concern itself with personal cost. And we have this great example in 2 Corinthians 8 of the Macedonian churches. In verse 8, they give to the Jerusalem church as a sincere act of love, not because they're expecting anything in return. We have no record that they were focusing primarily on what it cost to them. In fact, in verse 2 it says, in a great ordeal of affliction, their abundance of liberality, their abundance of joy and deep poverty overflowed in the wealth of liberality. They were so gracious, even though they didn't quite have the means to do it, they gave even beyond what they could. How could they give like this? Well, verse 5 says, because they first gave of themselves to the Lord. It wasn't about the other person and the return that they could get. It was about giving to the Lord. Number 4, genuine love does not consider the worthiness of the object. You know, I'll do this for this person as long as they're worthy of it. Aren't you thankful that God didn't love us in that way? You know, pretty sure when God looked at us, He didn't think, wow, what a find. I want that one. No, He saw us as we were, His enemy. Romans 5 says, while we were sinners, while we were enemies, while we were dead in our trespasses and sins, Ephesians 2, unworthy, unlovely, God looked at us and said, that one. I'm going to put my love on that one. And if we're going to love like the Father, then we need to stop considering the worthiness of the object and consider what genuine love looks like. See, the problem with Chapman's book is that much of it points back to me. What can I get out of it if I engage in these activities? So, quickly, let's go to what genuine love is. I would call it this: selfless sacrificial service for the good of another. Selfless sacrificial service for the good of another. Genuine love is modeled for us in the Father and the Son. God's love came to us despite our unworthiness and inability and our ability to ever pay back what He's done for us. Aren't you thankful that God is not keeping score? Like, you know, I've done all these things and my record's really high, so when are you going to match up to mine? Fact is, we can't. In this lifetime or the next, we will never, ever match the level of love that God has shown to us. That's the kind of love we ought to express to other people. Not keeping a record. Trying to get the other person to match up what we've done for them. The Bible commands that we love others similarly to how God loves us. And this is why the quest for genuine love should never get old. We keep digging and digging into the revelation of how God loved us. Marvel in it. And the more that we see it, the more we see we need to grow in how we express that to other people. And the motive in this is not so that I get something out of it, but so that the other person receives something and that God receives the glory in it. Genuine biblical love is selfless, sacrificial service for the good of another. It's selfless. It doesn't seek reciprocation. It's not about getting love back. Philippians 2:3 says, in humility, consider others as better than yourselves. Do nothing out of selfish ambition. It's sacrificial. It doesn't take into account personal cost. How much is this going to cost me? Our posture ought to be one in which we're just constantly pouring ourselves out for the sake of others. This demands self-denial. Another way to describe this love is one-way grace. It's not two-way. It's not I give, you give. We kind of give back and forth, and eventually we're kind of at this manageable relationship level where we can really love each other. No, it's I'm just going to keep on giving. I don't care what happens in return. So, three applications quickly. Number one, you still have work to do. And so do I. The quest of genuine love will never end. We can never say, I've got it figured out fully and completely, and I'm practicing it perfectly, practically practicing it perfectly in every way, in every relationship in my life. Right? We can't say that. So we must always be on this quest for genuine love. Always be learning about what God's love looks like for us. Always be learning from others who've gone before us and who've loved well. We still have work to do because the pressures in life reveal what's really in our heart and what we really desire, doesn't it? Before I got married, I thought I was a pretty spiritual person. I thought I might have been the most spiritual person I knew. And then I got married. And marriage has a way of revealing what your true motives are. Because it's easy when you're by yourself, and you're loving yourself a lot, and you just kind of stay away from the people that are... But when you get married, you start to see that a lot of the choices that you're making, a lot of the ways that you're living are designed to come back and circle back to you. And that starts to get exposed. You start to realize what kind of selfish person you are. At least that's the way it was for me. Tim Keller in his book, The Meaning of Marriage, says, I was self-centered before I got married. Why should I suddenly think that I would turn into an angel when I got married? The fact is, when going into marriage, I already loved myself and I just wanted someone else to join me in loving me. And what I found was that I was actually a pretty unlovely and self-centered kind of person, and it's something that I've had to work at and hopefully still am. So, the work's not done. Secondly, put the scorecard away. One of the things I love about sports is that you have a clear winner. You know, both teams get points, and at the end, we know who wins. But in relationships, you're not competing with the other person. So put the scorecard away. It's not a sporting event. The posture of love ought to be service, not reciprocation. If anything, we ought to follow what Paul said in Romans 12:10. He says, outdo one another in showing each other honor. So you try to make sure that you're outdoing the person. That's, if there's going to be a point system, that's the way it has to be. Not in order to get something in return, but to make sure that they're being served and honored. One of the ways that we reflect God's goodness and kindness and love is to pour out our love to someone else, irrespective of what they did this morning. Irrespective of that thing that's still hanging in the back of our mind that's just wearing on us. Irrespective of nagging and indifference and selfishness. I'm not calling us to overlook sin. Never confront someone with their sin. But the posture ought to be one of selfless service. To walk home from work at night, guys, and pick up the towel and serve like Jesus did at the dinner. He got down on his feet and served worthless creatures. And then finally, we must strive for love. Pursue love. Love is not an option. This is the command that we started with in Ephesians 5. Pursue love. Flee godless things and pursue after righteousness and these other things and love. Love is the first of the fruit of the Spirit for a reason, I think. I think it's the foundation of all the other fruit of the Spirit. It's the foundation of the list in 2 Peter 1, 2 through 11. Add to these things, actually the culmination, the foundation is faith. The other things we add to them, and then it culminates in love. It's the summary of the Old Testament law. It's the summary of the law of Christ that we must love God. We must love others. And to use the language of the Apostle John, if we don't love people in this way, this one-way grace kind of way, if we don't love our spouse whom we have seen, if we don't love our parents whom we have seen, if we don't love our children whom we have seen, how can we say that we love God whom we have not seen? This is what we are called to do. This is genuine love. It is selfless, sacrificial service for the good of another. It's one-way grace. That's the kind of love that God showed to us. Let's pray.